Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
We'll go back in time. The season's past. When 22 men graced the record fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, and one final chance that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, history and its memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. We're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at Gridiron Greats Magazine. Yeah. It's at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine of Football, memorabilia historian, specializing in free World War II items, in particular Rick Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Spur. Yeah.
So good to be back, Captain. Very good to be back.
Did you have a good vacation?
Love it. I did, yeah, and I listened to the podcast. Thank you, Jeff Payne, for stepping in. Amazing job on the show. It's funny, I don't usually listen to the shows that we do, but I got back and listened to your guys' show. It was great. It was a great dynamic.
I have to thank Jeff publicly also because, again, it's tough to fill in your shoes, number one, but also tough to just pick up on something right away and talk about it in a very short period of time. And Jeff is being a football historian and a collector of the highest level. I appreciate his help immensely. We're going to get on with our show, and we're going to talk first about the 1935 National Chickle Set before our guest comes on. And the 35 National Chickle Set, and I've talked about this before in the past, it's a set I started and stopped and sold off three different times on three different occasions. Last time selling it off was in 2016, and I started that set way back in the 80s. I sold it in the early 90s, time number one. Time number two, roughly around 2002, 2003, I sold off everything else I had the second run. About a year later, I started collecting it again, and then I sold it off in 2016 for the final time. I do not own 135 Chickle. One day I'll pick up again another type card just to have it. For many collectors and football collecting and football memorabilia and football card collecting. They feel the 35 Chico is the first mainstream set that has actually professional players in it as compared to the Spalding, compared to the Pottstown set, compared to the 1894 Mayo set. And now I'm going to lead off and hand off to you, Joe. Fill us in on a few more areas on this set.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, to most football collectors, the 35 Chickle is the first football set. You know, you and I were laughing before the show. We would be burned in effigy on VFC if we left it with that, because as we know, we've had many guests on the show talking about the 1926 Pottsville Maroon set, which is the first set devoted to professional football players. Postcards, very thinly traded. A lot of people, you know, who consider themselves, you know, football collectors probably aren't aware of this set. So, you know, the 1894 set, as you mentioned, is college players. So 35 Chickle is the first mainstream NFL set collected. Let's leave it at that. And a lot of us, wink, wink, nod, nod, know a little bit better. But I've mentioned a few times on the show my my white whale would be a 35 Chickle uncut sheet. You know, it would just be, that's the white whale. That's, you know, honey, I got to sell, you know, I got to pull a second mortgage on the house kind of thing. 36 cards, obviously, in the set. What I love about the set is on the flip side of every set, it talks about one of 240 cards in a set. The mystery that surrounds, you know, did they intend to do 240? Were those chase? Was that a chase so that people kept buying more packs, hoping for the next series that came out? Were they issued in series? Were they on, you know, two 18 card sheets? Were 1 through 18 double print and the 19 through 36 single print? You know, so many mysteries. And coming across an uncut sheet would solve a lot of that. If it's on a, you know, if it's a 9x4 sheet, then, you know, with 36 cards, we know there are no double prints. And the only thing I have to correlate it to is the 1933 Sports King, which was printed in one sheet. Different companies, but if you, I mentioned on a previous show the Chickle Skybird set. You know, there was an uncut sheet for sale about 2 years ago, and how they laid the sheet out was all single print. The Skybird, you know, has a few more cards in the set. I think it's 40. But I don't know. How it was printed, how the sheets were laid out, single print, double print, all that is, you know, wrapped in a mystery. 240 cards, were they planning on more? I think most collectors that I talked to think no, that it was always meant to be 36 cards. And that was, you know, who knows? Maybe if the set would have, you know, flown off the shelves, maybe they would have made more. But you know, who knows?
Right.
What's interesting? And that, 35 isn't that long ago, you know.
I know we've talked about that short print and the sheet configuration several times in the past. And again, it's open and up to interpretation as far as, you know, what actually and how they actually printed it, so on and so forth. I did mention in one time we had talked about it, my theory always was I really thought they were going to come out with more cards, and then for whatever reason, the Depression, World War II coming on, so on and so forth, they just stopped printing the cards, and that was it. They ended it, you know. So we really don't know, and until you discover the uncut sheet and you see the layout, then that will make a lot more sense one way or the other to the reason why those are short printed. Now, I'm going to point out, too, and something I've talked about this in the past, too. When I started collecting that stuff back in the 1980s, I never saw any cards number 24 to 36 ever at a show anywhere I went. And And the handful of cards I saw all the time, for whatever reason, was the Ken Strong card. And
yeah,
believe it or not, card number 14. So those two cards seemed to be very prevalent when I was looking for them, and I picked them up. And the first trickle I ever bought back in probably 1983, 84 was the Kenny Strong card. And over the years, that was the most, and to me, the most simplest card to pick up in the set as compared to all the other sets. And I didn't see the high numbers until the late 90s in actuality. I mean, at a show, I never saw a high number until the late 90s. So I saw them, and I obviously saw them in SCD and mail order catalogs, so on and so forth. But actually seeing them up close physically, it was in the late 90s, so it was always interesting to me. And again, the third time I collected the set was the time I had the most high numbers at that time, which drove the value of
And you knew the set was numbered to 36. You just only saw 1 through 24,
right.
You know. Okay.
I mean, If I had it with me, I wish I could pull it out. It was my old Beckett number 5 big guide, which was the basketball, hockey, football guide, and see how marked up my 35 checklist was there.
Yeah.
With little notes and connotations that I made and prices that I saw, so on and so forth. And it was never a high priority for me because I was always working on the main run 48 up. You know what I mean? But I said once I finished the run, and I never did, was I was going to finish the 35 trickle and then go into the 1894 Mayos and fill those up, too. Finish those off.
Zero doubt about it. 1 through 24, you get a lot more common than 25 to 36.
Right.
I mean, you know, a lot more. I mean, the Bull Posey is the rarest card. I think there's like, I mean, you know, the Nagurski card number 34 is rare. There are six PSA 8s, one PSA 8.5 that sold about 2 years ago, and then a one PSA 9, obviously, that's owned by PP Properties. There's six PSA 8s. There are four PSA 8 Bull Tosies, and one of them is, you know, one of them came up for sale about 3 years ago, and it was so obviously trimmed, it made me vomit my mouth. But, I mean, mm-hmm. You know, was it a larger sheet? You know, was it 60 cards? 1 through 24 was a double print, and the other 12 were single prints. I mean, they made the sheet smaller way back then, you know, but 1935 isn't so long ago when you think about it. It's just, we've never seen a 48 leaf pack. I've never heard of, a 1935 Chickle wax pack either. I mean, it's fascinating.
Right.
No one bought these things, stuffed them away. But,
well, you know, the other thing too, I never really saw when I started collecting this set, I never really saw high grade cards. I would say I saw more high grade 35 Chickles than I did 48 and 49 Leafs back in the '80s and early '90s, before they got you know, things started getting touched up and everything. But I did see a fair share of X-35 Chickles, and the first time I put the set together, my grade was basically GVG, and that was it, because I was just happy to find it type of thing. But as the years went on, I did see, and I've always said this, I saw more or better condition 35 Chickle low numbers than I did with the 48 and 49 Leafs when I first started collecting. So that's another interesting view to look at with the set. And again, giving your pop numbers, I can't really see a lot of perfect 35 Chickles out there anywhere. You know what I mean?
The 48 leaf set, very wide swings on the dimensions, as we've mentioned before. I mean, 10% overage at some points, 50 millimeters all the way up to 55 millimeters. You know, and the thought is they didn't think 48 leaf would take off. So they had printer apprentices working on it, which is where you get the color variations, which is where you get the wild, size swings. So the I've talked to a couple, you know, professional, you know, printers, and they're like, yeah, they likely had an apprentice working on this because a professional printer wouldn't do this. And one of the ways I built what, you know, I kind of built what the 48-leaf uncut sheet would look like was by gross miscut cards, by being able to see adjacent cards, you know, and piece it together. And then by the time I pieced it together, you know, I realized, you know, other people had, you know, kind of built it, you know, Mirrorman Mike. I've searched for years for five Chico cards just to see a possible glimpse of Jason cards, be a clue how they were laid out on a sheet. And I've never, ever once seen a grossly miscut 35 Chico card that gives a clue into what's next door. Still no idea even how a sheet is laid out.
So, and again,
we shall see.
We'll throw it out to our audience. If you have a 35 Chico uncut sheet, you're holding on to it, contact us. We know Joe is interested.
And there have been, you know, the different signatures on the back of the Chicles, because there's, two or three, I think Doug Spanning, like 10 years ago, did a Gridiron Great article on the variations of the signatures on the back.
Yep.
So there's definitely, you know, multiple print runs of it. But if you search your collection and you see miscut Chicles, I'd love an email. And as the captain said, if you know the roundabout, you know, whereabouts of uncut sheet, I'd definitely like to hear from you. But definitely one of the, you know, top football sets, the first, you know, mainstream professional football sets, you know, with a nod to the Mayo and the Pottsville Maroons, you know, postcard set that we all know about.
It's classic vintage set. And again, be aware if you're not knowledgeable of the set, study it, because there was a reprint set of the Chicles out there, and unless you know what color backs you're looking at, you could be buying a reprint card, which may be advertised as being a real 35 Chicle, and it's not, because the reprint set that came out, and I want to say it was probably in the 80s. Or early 90s, I'm not sure. Had a different color backing than the regular 35 Chicles. So be aware of that at the same time. All right, our guest is here, and we got a lot to go over tonight, and I'm going to introduce him now, and we'll get started with our regular segment of our show. Our special guest tonight has been a collector of cards and memorabilia since his mom bought him his first pack of Topps baseball cards back in 1977. His career took him through a few different industries until he started a small advertising agency in 2004. He began working with several different companies in the hobby, including grading companies and auction houses. In 2012, he sold his advertising agency and started Love of the Game Auctions, which he has been running ever since. Love of the Game Auctions have prided themselves on being a trustworthy, high-quality boutique catalog auction, an alternative to the large catalog auctions, focusing on historically important sports cards and memorabilia. His auction house has been a longtime advertiser and supporter of Gridiron Greats magazine, and I'd like to welcome to our show this evening, Mr. Al Crisafulli. Al, welcome to the show.
So great to talk to you guys.
Al Fox, good to have you on the show.
How have you been?
Good.
Thanks for coming on, Al.
Very good.
I appreciate it.
Everybody staying healthy. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you had a business meeting yesterday and were tied up, and you're able to make it today. I appreciate it, and our audience appreciates it, too. And I want to lead off by asking you, why did you decide to start Love of the Game Auctions?
So, interesting. I owned this advertising agency, and I became very disillusioned with the advertising industry. It's almost like I woke up one morning and I realized that everything I was doing was disposable, right? So, you know, I was designing websites that were obsolete after 3 years, and I was designing, you know, advertisements and direct mail campaigns that you throw in the garbage and forget about. And it just seemed to me that, you know, I could be doing something more meaningful with my career. And meanwhile, here I was participating in this great hobby where there's such rich history and there's, you know, connecting people to their memories and to nostalgia and to the history of the country and the history of the sports that we love. It just seemed to be, you know, just so much more meaningful. And so I literally just one day did it without a net. I sold my shares of the ad agency and started Love of the Game, and here I am. And I couldn't be happier.
I love that. Leap in the net will appear. I love that. Good for you, Al.
Yeah. Thanks.
I remember when you did that. I was privileged enough to have some consignments in your first auction.
You were a huge early supporter, and that was, you know, that first auction was, you know, was really make or break. And you know, I was fortunate enough to have some excellent friends that were willing to, you know, to consign to a person who had zero bidders. I'll never forget those people who were, you know, such great supporters early on.
Yeah, Jason Cassidy, I think you've mentioned him a few times.
Sure.
But yeah.
Yeah, Jason was a huge help.
Yeah, no kidding. But I saw you at the National, sat at your table for quite a bit. I always appreciate the nice oasis of being able to, you know, crash at your booth. I know you have an auction coming up that's getting ready to pop. Tell us about a couple of the things in your auction, and I know our audience wants to know if you have any Steve Largent items coming up.
I have none in this auction. They're very scarce, Steve Largent. But we're in the process of putting the finishing touches on the auction and getting ready to send it to our graphic designer to work her magic. And I'm really happy with this auction. It's been a great year for us. But I think what's interesting about this auction is probably the selection of memorabilia. We're getting back into the collection of Ted Patterson. Ted was a longtime broadcaster on the baseball side for Baltimore Orioles, but he also did Navy football for 13 years. He did Baltimore Colts and Ravens games, and he was kind of a fixture in the Mid-Atlantic there and accumulated a massive collection of stuff. So we've been going through over the last month or so his collection of programs and scorecards and have found some really cool early football programs and things like that, which I'm really excited about. And then we also have a nice collection of football sets coming up that we started with our last auction from a collector up in Vermont. All original owner stuff. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's been if you paid attention to our last auction, we had a nice Namath rookie in 7. Came out of his collection. It was all original owner stuff, and essentially what he did was he would work on the set by pulling the cards out of the packs the year they were issued, and then when the cards were no longer available, he would move on to the next sport. He never went back and tried to upgrade or never filled in any of the holes. He would just move on to the next sport, and he continued to do that even in the 90s when he got tired of opening the packs. He would just go out and buy the boxes, so we've got hundreds of unopened boxes from the 90s and the early 2000s. Yeah, it's a pretty cool collection. It's a lot of fun.
Unopened as well, or just
the unopened. They're all wax and foil boxes, mostly 90s and 2000s.
Okay.
And the consigner, he's been he was pretty good with his consignment though of weeding out, you know, what we like to call the junk wax, which is a lot of times the fun stuff to open, but we really just took kind of the good stuff. So there's a nice assortment of that stuff coming. But again, you know, a lot of complete sets and near sets from the 60s and 70s as well, which is fun.
Incredible.
Yeah. It's probably our best football assortment that we've ever had the last two auctions.
Al, a quick question. I am very, very taken back by your online catalog, which is just an incredible design where you can actually turn the pages of what it amounts to being the real catalog if you have the printed catalog in front of you. Can you give us a little background on that?
I love that.
Yeah,
even
sure.
Even the little click noise it makes when you click on the page.
little page turning noise. You know, we understand that there are people. You'll never be able to replace the printed catalog for some people, and you know, once we started doing it, I realized that from a design standpoint, there are certain things that I can do with a printed catalog that I can't do with just that online scrolling grid that we all have. Like, for example, it's very difficult to convey size, right? You can't really convey the same, everything's the same size. So in a printed catalog, I can make things bigger. I can emphasize things that are more important by adding words, you know, adding a description, making it larger and that sort of thing. So there are some advantages to the printed catalog, but there are also a lot of people who don't want a printed catalog. They do everything online. So I wanted to come up with a way that we could translate that sort of tactile feel of flipping through a book and stopping in your tracks when there's something big and beautiful on a page, but to do it electronically. So you know, the format that we're using gives you the ability to do it on your desktop, but I think more importantly, it also gives you the ability to do things on your phone and on your tablet. So you can page through the catalog on your phone, and then you can even do things like, you know, make notes. And, you know, the other thing that we do sometimes is in the online catalog, we can incorporate video into that. So, mm-hmm. So you know, where wow. I have the, yeah, where I have the space to do it, you know, like, for example, we sold the, I'm trying to think of the, I think it was the Alan Ameche jersey that we did this with, where we sold an Alan Ameche jersey from the 50s or 60s that, you know, we wanted some video of the highlights from the championship game where he scored the touchdown, you know, the greatest game ever played. And I think it was that jersey where we just embedded the video right onto that page of the catalog. So you're flipping through like it's a catalog, but then all of a sudden, you know, there's a little button, and you click the button, and you can watch the video. And you know, we find that that's a nice way to supplement on important item. Yeah.
Yeah.
You do such a good job with your
online catalog.
Yeah.
The online catalog is just superb. I mean, it's so interesting to have the actual feel of the catalog. And Brenda and I have always said we really would like to go to that route with Gridiron Grapes with the magazine. But at the same time, we have a lot of, like, and I know you and I talked about this at a dinner several years ago at one of the Nationals, where we said we still have the older collector who lives for the printed catalog, the printed magazine, the printed word type of thing. And you still got to print for them. You still got to provide them with that. But at the same time, what, you know, the design of your catalog is just amazes me every time I
really appreciate that, Bob. That's super nice. And we spend a lot of time on it, and we're always thinking of ways that we can increase. I mean, if we're going to print the book, right, I would like to create a piece of material that you don't throw in the garbage. You know, we're always looking at more ways that we can make that catalog more like a magazine and a reference material that you want to keep. And I think in the coming years, you'll see us do more and more of that, especially as we start to get more interesting collections that we, you know, where we're selling a full collection that has kind of more of a thematic sort of approach to it, and as opposed to just a listing of stuff like a lot of catalogs. So you know, the quality of the material also is what allows us to do that.
Yeah,
right. And again, just
your design background, just, you know, it really you know, you just, it's so obvious, you know, in your catalogs and stuff like that. Just your writing style, your intros, it really shines.
I appreciate it. It's funny because I am also the kind of person that if it wasn't for the fact, you know, you have to sort of bundle in a deadline because I would just continue to enhance it and refine it and refine it and refine it and never actually have the auction. So it's nice to have, you know, a date that it's got to be done by so that, you know, and I'm never happy, you know, I'm never happy with the catalog. So it's, you know, I have like degrees of, oh, I'm okay with it, you know.
Al, you have a very interesting way of collecting your consignments from different collectors and collections, and I know you travel extensively around the country for items for the auction. How did you come up with this idea, and can you share with our audience any stories about some of the road trips you had to pick up inventory for the auctions?
Well, the way I came up with it was probably the worst possible way of coming up with it, in that I'm absolutely terrified to fly, and so, you know, that made it really easy for me to not fly, and so what happened was some friends years ago, some of the folks that that helped us with consignments in our very first auction. I'm talking about Adam Warshaw, Anthony Nex, and Jason Miller. They're out in Southern California, and they put together a little community show that they wanted to do, like a little card and memorabilia show in Culver City, California. And I wanted to be able to support them the way they supported me. So I bought a table at their show, and it just got in the car and drove to California, and I figured, well, if I'm going to drive all the way out there, I should make some people aware of the fact that I'm coming and you know, see if I can't pick up some consignments while I'm going. And it wound up being it paid off. It was great. And so I've done it again and again. And so I generally hit each of the four corners of the country during the year. COVID has thrown a real monkey wrench into that. I haven't been on the road in 2 years, but I'm looking forward to getting back out there, starting to plan out a Florida trip for January, and then I'll be hitting the Pacific Northwest and the Southwest in 2022 for sure.
Nice.
Wow.
I dig that. I really like that because I've had you in my kitchen having a cup of coffee, you know, consigning stuff to you. So
sure.
I got to say, when somebody's coming to your house, when you don't have to ship it, when you don't have to package it, it makes it so much easier to go like, you know what? Yeah, you know, this is something I've always wanted to consign. I'm just too lazy to pack it, you know?
For sure. That's a big thing. And you know, but from my standpoint, there's something about, I mean, you know, the hobby is about stuff, but really, the longer you collect, the more you realize that it's really about people. And you know, the human element of this, after a while, you've known people, you've known collectors for 15, 20 years. You know, I don't want them to just mail me stuff. I want to go shake their hand. You know, a lot of times these are people I know, their families, and we've been friends for a long time. We've had dinner together. We've had beers at the bar. We've shared experiences, and I like for it to be, you know, as personal as it can be, because it's, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that's what this is all about. And so, you know, and that's what the hobby means to so many of us. So, you know, I want to always keep that, you know, and it's great because you can, you know, I try and mix in, you know, I sort of meander. I don't usually cannonball across the country to get to a place. I'll you know, sort of slowly, you know, mosey across the country. And if I see something cool, I will stop. This lends itself to some great experiences that a lot of people aren't fortunate enough to have. And some weird ones.
Yeah.
I got stuck in a blizzard in the Rocky Mountains one time. I had to sleep in a rest stop and eat, you know, Swedish fish for breakfast and lunch. And you know, I had my truck charged by a bison in Yellowstone Park once, which was a little weird and scary. You know, but there's, you know, I always get to come home with a story.
Yeah, great. I love following I forget which trip it was, but we went through Moab, and if you know, just, you know, your description of it, I'm like, all right, we got to go to Moab one of these days. So,
it's my favorite place in the world, you know, and I never would have seen it if I hadn't done one of these trips. I never would have even heard of it. You know, now I try and go there, you know, once a year and you know, ride, you know, I actually throw my bicycle on the back of the truck when I have my own truck so that I can do, you know, there's a lot of cycling in Moab, but I'll also, you know, just, there's a road that goes right along the Colorado River that you can just go out, you know, 20, 25 miles and just do a really nice, you know, beautiful bike ride. The scenery is fantastic, and it's just so peaceful. And you know, to do that right in the middle of work, what a lucky guy am I, you know, that I can, I can just do that. So,
good point. Well, let's change gears here and talk about that a recent blight on the hobby. Well, maybe not so recent. PWCC, and you know, Brent Hudgens. I mean, recently banned from eBay. FBI investigating them, you know, kind of full court press at the National. Now, I've known you a long time. I've consigned things with you. I know you take a lot of pride in being transparent, honest. You're one of those auction houses, you know, that's just, everybody knows they're getting a fair shake. I know it's tough, you know, for stuff, you know, quote unquote stuff to trump integrity like that in some places. You know, talk about that in the hobby and how hard that is.
You know, it's frustrating. It's not that it's hard. I mean, it's easy to do the right thing. It's easy to run a business where you just run it the right way. And that was part of, you know, when I started the company, you know, that was part of the deal that I sort of made with myself, is that, you know, I want this to be up and up. I want to do everything the right way, and I'm not interested in you know, cutting corners or you know, just for lack of a better term, wearing the black hat. I want to wear the white hat, and if that means that I have to you know, take a little bit of a hit financially, that's okay, because I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror in the morning. It's easy to do that. It's, you know, what's tough and frustrating is watching collectors continue to go back to that well and bid with companies that are less than ethical. And you know, it's like, you know, that's the frustrating part of it, because you would think, you know, and again, I'm not naming names, but, you know, we've heard a lot of the names, and you know, it's frustrating to see collectors just continue to go back, even though they know, know what's going on. Yeah. Just because the stuff is there, because the stuff wouldn't be there if the bidders weren't there. You know, you know, and there are plenty of people in the hobby who are doing things the right way. There are plenty of, you know, this is, you know, my company's not the only ethical auction house. There, you know, we could sit here and rattle them off. You know, companies like REA are as solid as they get, and you know, there are plenty more like that. So you know, it's frustrating, but it's certainly not the kind of thing that's going to make me stop doing business. You know, we're doing fine, and you know, what we can offer is an alternative where you know, the auction house is not complicit in some you know, shady dealings. You know, there are none happening here.
And it's a chicken and egg thing. I've always wondered why the hell people continue consign to nefarious auction houses. I mean, and the only answer I can have is because they get better prices, because they, you know, they shill bid, because, you know, et cetera. And that's the tough part.
I think that's why a lot of these investigations take so long to progress, because there's that, you know, we all have sort of this weird relationship with the hobby where we are all buyers and sellers kind of at the same time, right? And so, you know, you're a collector, but then you get some dupes, or you finish a project and you want to sell it off to fund a different project, or you get bored with something and so, you know, you sell it. So once you sell it, you want to sell it for the highest price that you can. And so it's very tempting to look at every possible resource and say, you know, where can I move this piece of my collection or whatever. And you know, we know the names, and there's a laundry list of them out there, and, you consign to every one of them. So do you want to consign to the one that, consistently posts, you know, high prices, even though there's questions about whether the prices are actually real? Or, you know, do you want to maybe, I don't know, I mean, the decision is an easy one for me, but I can understand why it's not an easy one for everyone. Especially now in this crazy climate, this is real money.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the risk of, anybody who has something consigned with PWCC right now is taking their collection into into the wrong hands. It's a risk because, you know, if PWCC gets raided, you know, while their consignments are sitting there, good luck getting those back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
a big problem for the hobby, and, you know, we've talked about this numerous times. I've written about it numerous times, and you know, it's just, will it ever end? I doubt it, seriously. But, you know, collectors, again, like you say, Al, and it's a good point. They want the highest amount of money they possibly can get, and, you know, they're willing to close their eyes to a lot of this stuff, and it's just not healthy for the hobby.
If you have any appreciation for the history of the hobby itself, right, and not just the stuff, not just the material that we collect, but the history of the actual hobby, then you understand that we're sort of stewards of the hobby, all of us, as we participate in collecting and all of this. Eventually, you know, our material is going to pass through our hands, and the health of the hobby is also going to move on to another generation of people. It's very disconcerting to people who are starting in the hobby, to hear about the kind of things that cause real trust issues and issues about, you know, the authenticity of the pieces and whether the pieces have
Good
been,
point.
You know, altered. And so, I kind of look at this and feel like it's a privilege to be able to be a part of this and be a part of this thing that's been here for so long and actually make money at it. I want to leave it better than it was when I got it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I just wish everyone else in the hobby felt that same way.
I agree with that. Al, do you have a consignment that, above all other consignments, you would like to pick up besides my collection when I get rid of it? What is your one whale consignment?
It's interesting because I was sitting here and I was listening to you guys talk about the National Chickle set, and it's a fascinating set to me for a lot of different reasons, primarily because it the cards are beautiful and the artwork is so similar to the Diamond Stars and the Skybirds cards that it's almost like you can pass these, you know, this entire design through an entire year of trading cards, right? But the Nagurski was the first high-end card that I sold. In my very first auction, we had a PSA 7 Nagurski, and I feel like I want to sell an 8. And that's sort of, you know, there's an 8, you know, there's however many 8s, there's an 8.5 and a 9, and I would love to sell one of those because I really want to know what is that card worth in a trustworthy public auction, you know, not in a private transaction, not, you know, yeah. what would it be worth to just put that card out there and sell it to the highest bidder? What would that high bid be? Just, I'm curious, and I'm dying to know, and I would love to be the auction house, to the next auction house, to sell that a card of that caliber.
I like it.
That'd be cool.
They say in sales, you know, they say in sales, tell everybody what you're after specifically. You know, not like, hey, we'd love your business. It's like, I'm looking for a, you know, PSA, you know, 1935
Nagurski. Like that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for eight or better, and you know, we'll put it right up in the front of the catalog and give it some great attention, and let's see. Let's roll the dice and see what the hobby thinks that card is worth. I am maddeningly curious.
The 8.5 sold a couple years ago. I want to say it went for like 160, something like that.
Yeah,
plus
174 in Heritage in 2019. And we've had a massive explosion in the hobby, as we all know. You know, prices. You know, as we're assembling the auction, the next auction, and, you know, I try and do estimates to try and just to get a feel for what kind of auction this next auction is going to be. And for the last three auctions, it's impossible to estimate because the prices have gone through the roof so crazily that you know, I'm looking at different cards that sold. The last time they sold for, you know, $1,500, and the next time they sell, they're going to sell for $20,000. So, you know, $174K for a PSA 8.5 Nagurski in August of 19, and you know, what's it worth now? Is it worth five times that? Is it worth 10 times? I don't know. That's my holy grail card.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
That 8.5 was so good looking. It was nicer than the 9, in my opinion. It was such a nice looking card. I had a couple of feeler bids on it. I had to go to Stacy and ask if, it wasn't in the cards for me to get it.
Sometimes it's better to ask forgiveness than permission, Joe.
Says the guy who owns an auction house.
I like that.
You know, I might have to sleep on your couch if I would have done that to Stacey. I know you've mentioned a few times, like, nationals, like, you know, when they hold the national in one place over and over again, you've kind of gotten the consignments you can from a certain area. You know, what are your thoughts on the activity of the last, you know, Chicago National and then next year's AC, you know, Atlantic City National?
So I think it's there's a couple of layers to that question, because I do agree and I talk about it all the time that I think, you know, I would like to see the national travel more for a couple of reasons. From my standpoint, I do at shows is get consignments and show what's in my next auction. And so when you keep going back to that same well, it's the same people every other year, it's hard to bring in new consignments. With the best show we ever had, the best national we ever had, was Atlantic City, and I don't think it's because it was in Atlantic City. I think it's because it was the first time it was in Atlantic City or in New Jersey in years, you know. And so I would love to see other cities in the Midwest, places like St. Louis and Kansas City, where there's the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. It would be a fantastic place for the show. But that being said, this last national in Chicago, I think between the incredible explosion in the hobby and the fact that we were all locked in our house for a year, the attendance was unbelievable. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. And I think the best part about it to me was the amount of kids. There were so many kids. And it was just, you know, that was really refreshing to see. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Al, when's the next auction, and when are consignments due for it?
So the next auction closes on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and consignment deadline is already passed for that one. So we would already be looking for consignments for our spring auction, which would be in a March-April time frame, and we've got some time on consignments. We generally close that one up in around February. So, but the next auction, the one to look for, is the one that closes the Saturday after Thanksgiving. It should open somewhere around the 10th of November. So if any of the listeners are not currently registered, you should go to loveofthegameauctions.com. And you can register there, and we'll get you set up so that you get all of our emails and all of that, so you know when the auction goes live.
Nice. And I've got a couple consignments in there, so I wish you well.
Me too.
You mentioned you hired You mentioned you in our emails back and forth. You hired a new inventory manager, and I know that that's a big step up for you. Tell us about his role, and does the guy ever make fun of your mullet?
My mullet is beyond. You're not allowed to make fun of my mullet, and so I am trying to surpass you and Levi Bleem of 707 Sports Cards for the best mullet in the hobby, and so you know I'm working on that. I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it. In terms of our inventory manager, his name is Andrew Aronstein. He's got a long history in the hobby. Longtime collectors remember the name TCMA, which was a company that made baseball cards in the 70s and 80s and actually is still active in the hobby. And Andrew's father is one of the founders of TCMA. So Andrew's got a long, long background in the hobby. And what he's going to be doing with us is interfacing directly with consigners, making sure that the consignments that come in, making sure we do a better job of communicating when we receive the consignments, when the stuff is going out for grading, when it comes back, how did it grade, you know, were there any issues, that sort of thing, and then sort of shepherding those consignments through the process so that everything gets smoothly entered into the system and photographed and scanned and everything, just to sort of streamline that process. We're pretty good at it. But I feel like, you know, when it comes to organization and communication, there's really not, you can't really ever do too well at that. You should always improve. And so we're really looking for it. Andrew's been with us for about 3 weeks now, and I'm already seeing a big improvement.
Well, congrats.
Plus, I don't have to do that stuff anymore.
You did an amazing job. Yeah, you've always done an amazing job tracking, shipping, you know, packaging. So, yeah, this is that's exciting to see, just a step up in that. Congratulations. That means consignments are coming and auctions are rolling.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. I want to do this forever. I'm having way too much fun to ever do anything else.
A pop quiz for both of you. What were the 2 years TCMA printed a football card set?
Oh, my God. God, that is a heck of a question. Tell me what they
81?
Are.
Was it 1981 one of them, Bob?
Yep.
1981. Was it a team set or was it a...
No, it was like a great set, football greats. But they had a second set, which was much more rare. It was an update set. What year was that from? And if you don't have the answer, we'll come back next show and find out.
I should have the
answer
at my fingertips, except he's in the other room taking pictures.
Yeah, well, was that, Bob?
The next show, you're going to fill us in on that update. So that's going to be your assignment.
I will get the answer to that question.
And... Al, when I saw his name and I didn't read his bio, I just read what the emails were saying, and I thought to myself, I wonder if he was related to the family with TCMA, and he was.
Yep.
So that's cool.
Yep.
Good family. Good family.
It's great, great history. I mean, you know, going back to like the very first National, you know, the things that we do in the hobby.
Right.
That, you know, his father's a pioneer. You know, so it's a pleasure to have that kind of passion and lineage that's part of Love of the Game now, and you know, that's just an honor.
Al, I love the final the prologues. I love the prologues for each auction. They're always so personal. The from the heart. I don't want to say they remind me of Joey O's, you know, SMR thing, but you know, they're in that spirit. They're much better. Excuse me, not Turner's now. Sorry, I shouldn't have. I'm leading up to something fun. I should have.
I mean, you're setting the bar. You know, they're better than Joe's. You know, I don't know that that's a high.
Never get cheated, Al. Never get cheated.
Yeah.
You need a tagline, is what you need, brother. But we were talking about stuff earlier, and somehow stuff trumps. And one of the things that to me cemented you in the hobby. I mean, obviously, love you, always have, but we have a mutual dear friend, Jim Blumenthal, who passed away, and the prologue in the auction you had next that just started off with stuff. You know, sometimes, you know, we get bogged down in stuff, and it's actually the friends that you acquire in the hobby.
And I
saved that catalog. That one still, you know, kind of hits me. It was just it was so from the heart. It made me just realize that it's so much more to that, you know, to the hobby than stuff for you. And it reminds me of just what you were saying. It's like a lot of these guys are friends.
It is. These are human beings. Jim's loss was a crushing loss for me. He was just a great man, and his smiling face. I mean, I can't say enough about how much I love that guy. And there are so many other guys in the hobby that are like that, you know. And when I sit back and I start to think about, you know, people who are my oldest and dearest friends. I'm in my early 50s. I've some of these guys are people that I've known for decades now, and so it's really not. I mean, of course, I love the material. You know, I love the material in my own collection. It's a privilege to be able to handle the kind of quality that comes through here, but you know, there's nothing that's ever going to take the place of those, you know, long nights at the bar at the National, just laughing, right, for days, just laughing and goofing around and having fun the one or two times a year that we all get to be together and see each other. That's what the hobby is. It's you know, when I was a kid, it was a solitary thing or a thing that you did with the kids in your neighborhood or whatever, but now these are lifelong friendships, right? So what could, you know, I don't want to write in the catalog about, you know, oh, this is a great thing that's for sale. That, you know, that's, you know, I feel like what's coming from me needs to transcend all that stuff a little bit, because I want to convey what this hobby is to me personally in that segment of the book.
Now, we're running out of time. Quickly, any suggestions for a beginning collector in our hobby?
Yes. Collect what you like, and don't worry about what it's worth. And I think it's really important to try and focus on the thing that you like and become an authority on that thing. Learn everything there is to learn about it, to turn it inside out, learn all of the different nuances and what makes that thing that you like important, and become a specialist in it, and then meet other collectors. That's the best part of the hobby.
That's great advice. Al, I really thank you for the support you've given Gridiron Greats Magazine over the years. I, as our regular readers and listeners know, you're an advertiser. That inside front cover is yours. People look forward to your auctions coming up. And, again, I thank you for being on our show this evening. I thank you for your support of the magazine over the years. It is appreciated. And it's interesting, you talk about being a boutique auction house. We were called, Gridiron Greats Magazine was called several times a boutique publication for football memorabilia, because it is so specialized.
Sure.
And it is not something you're going to see at Barnes & Noble type of thing.
It's a vital resource. Yeah, Gridiron Greats is a vital resource. There are things, you know, I consult my, you know, I have a run of Gridiron Greats, and I consult them constantly. You know, there's nothing else out there. There are very few hobby publications, and so what you're doing, and the fact that you're just a guy who's doing it out of the passion and the love for the hobby, you know, it's really important. It's a pleasure to support that.
I thank you for it. Thank you for your support, and thank you for being on tonight. We're almost out of time. Al, thank you for being on, and we're in our two-minute warning and wrap-up with 30 seconds to go. Joe, quick. Hand it off to you.
Al, thank you.
Tonight, Joe.
I just wanted to say thanks again, Al, for being on. We've been trying to get you on the show for a while just to talk about love of the games. And, yeah, it's just one of my favorite auction houses. I love consigning with you. So, classy guy. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And, again, if you're not a if you haven't signed up for Love of the Game Auctions for their next auction to bid, please do so. And if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. All right, we're out of time, and thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll be back next week with another episode. Take care.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.